Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
What might be called the first intimation of strangeness occurred at the railroad station. She had come with her children, small John and her baby girl, to meet her husband when he returned from a business trip to Boston. Because she had been oddly afraid of being late, and perhaps even seeming uneager to encounter her husband after a week's separation, she dressed the children and put them into the car at home a long half hour before the train was due. As a result, of course, they had to wait interminably at the station. And what was to have been a charmingly staged reunion, family embracing husband and father, became at last an ill-timed and awkward performance. Small John's hair was mussed and he was sticky. The baby was cross, pulling at her pink bonnet and her dainty lace-edged dress, whining. The final arrival of the train caught them in mid-movement, as it were. Margaret was tying the ribbons on the baby's bonnet. Small John was half over the back of the car seat. They scrambled out of the car, cringing from the sound of the train, hopelessly out of sorts.
Sometimes it feels like having any kind of expectation is just a really bad idea.
Yeah, that's what the Buddhists tell us. Mm. You can alleviate suffering if you can minimize your expectations and just accept reality as it is. However, accepting reality is not really something we do here on Strange Studies of Strange Stories, and it certainly is not happening in today's tale. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey, and today's tale is The Beautiful Stranger by Shirley Jackson.
A story about a stranger is just the thing for a strange study, but that reader's voice was familiar.
You may recognize that reader as Rachel Lackey. She is the host with me of Rachel Watches Star Trek.
Glad to have her back. Just like last week's reader, she is married to one of the hosts of this show. Today's story, I think, might be of particular interest for folks who have been in long relationships, but the concepts explored here are fairly universal, and I think apply to families, friendships, even parasocial relationships a little bit. Mm-hmm. To me, this tale is a perfect example of the form of what we call a strange story.
Just as with last week's tale, we found The Beautiful Stranger in the collection we're using all month, Dark Tales. But it was first published in Miss Jackson's collection, Come Along With Me, in 1968.
There is a Madonna song called Beautiful Stranger that some of you may find yourself humming upon hearing that title. It depends on how old you are. That Madonna song was featured on the soundtrack to the movie Austin Powers back in 1999.
Wow.
That was near the end of the trailer voiceover era.
Yeah.
The voiceover actor Don LaFontaine used to do all of those narrations for trailers, and he passed away in the aughts. Is around when those stopped happening. Mm-hmm. They also stopped happening because his opening line for trailers had well passed the point of parody. In a world,
yes,
in a world where water is scarce, one ninja needs to take a shower. That kind of thing.
Yes.
I mention all that because I want to transition into our story. And when I heard that opening, I couldn't help saying that horror trailer line that I quite predictably say on the show all the time. They were the perfect family.
Well, you start the story with a family attempting to look perfect. Our main character is a housewife named Margaret, and she is with her two small children, Small John, who seems to be about 3 years old, and the baby, who seems to be about 1 year old. They never name her, but she's a baby girl. Mm-hmm. They are waiting at the train station for Margaret's husband, John, to arrive back home from a business trip.
Margaret has attempted to orchestrate this picture-perfect greeting for her husband, but things aren't going as planned.
In that opening paragraph, there is a lot going on. The first thing that I got was how hard it is to have small children. And I loved having small kids, and I miss it a bit, but it is pretty all-consuming.
Yeah.
And her eagerness for her husband to return is completely understandable. But this is from a time when homemakers were a thing, as opposed to my time when I shared the load with my wife. One person would work. Back then, one person would spend all of their time taking care of the children in the household.
Yeah.
That's crazy to me. Rachel and I both did everything, but we also have outside interests, things that keep us occupied. So we're not constantly in this same world hanging out with tiny little kids.
Right.
Always.
You guys both worked and you both took care of the kids.
Exactly. Just spending time with those kids, I can see that being completely soul crushing.
Well, it's not something from the past. I mean, it happens all the time now where one person works and one person stays home. I mean, that still happens. At this point, it was the social norm that the woman did that in every instance, right? But certainly, I think people can relate to, hey, when there's young kids and if you have the ability to do that, having one person work and one person take care of them avoids childcare, which is so enormously expensive. So yes, it's still a solution. And yeah, if you're the only one that's with kids all day talking about kid things, doing kid stuff,
oh man,
no other adults,
it's
you'd
tough.
Be pretty happy when the other parent comes around.
What we do have here, it's a handoff scene. You've had responsibility for the kids for some time, and you're ready to hand back some of that responsibility. You want your partner to be keen on doing that, so you get the kids looking good and happy, and everybody's having a good time, and then it's here you go, here's your turn, and hopefully they'll be eager to take over.
Right.
But that's not what's happening here. She actually doesn't get a break, because her job is always taking care of the kids.
Mm-hmm.
So when her husband gets back, she'll still have to take care of the kids, and him as well.
Yeah.
So what is this all about? I think it's maybe about making herself look competent in her job. Her husband shows up and sees the kids are looking clean and happy, and he'll know she's a capable, confident woman and that he made the right choice marrying her.
Mm.
But that's not how things work out. She gets the kids all dressed up, but she does it too early and then gets to the station too early, and the kids get grumpy and messy, and it makes her look like she's a terrible mother. Or at least that's probably how she's feeling.
I have to nerd out on a word in the opening a bit. In the very first sentence, it says, what might be called the first intimation of strangeness occurred at the railroad station. I love the use of the word intimation. It's a nominalization what she's done there, changing the verb intimate into a noun. But to intimate means to communicate something delicately or under the surface, to hint at it.
Mm-hmm.
She intimated she would break up with the ninja if he didn't take a shower, that kind of thing.
Right.
It's the kind of communication that works usually only if the receiver is close enough to the communicator to be able to read the hint.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it is the same spelling as the adjective intimate, mm-hmm. which is why they're related. It's a great verb to kick off the story because it's all about what it means to be intimate. It's also about intimating, about communication that happens under the surface, things that are intimated between members of a couple, but also the word intimation can also easily be misread as imitation, which
right.
I believe is absolutely intentional. And it's wordplay that would make Edgar Allan Poe proud. In the first few words, this yeah. thing is about intimacy, and it's also about imitation. Also, we know there's trouble in that opening. It says she had been oddly afraid of being late and perhaps even seeming uneager to encounter her husband after a week's separation. She wants to be punctual, be the doting wife, having the kids looking good. I think there is a practical reason for that, as you pointed out, which it takes a parent to recognize, that handoff dressing up.
Yeah.
It's almost like Tom Sawyer talking about painting the fence and how great it is. You know, I love doing this. I almost don't want to give it up. Oh, you want to give it a try? But as you say, she doesn't get to hand the kids over. So what is this about? I think it's meant to manage his emotions.
Right.
She doesn't want to seem uneager because she knows that will communicate that she's still mad about something. Maybe even that she's not in love with him anymore, if she's not eager for him to show up.
Right.
And probably more dominantly, it feels like if she can present the perfect family, it might head off some negative consequences later.
Mm-hmm.
So she's trying to control things with this staged performance.
John, the husband, father, gets off the train looking totally put together, spiffy in his suit, well-rested.
In fact, she marvels at the fact that he looks even more produced than them. Like, he'd been waving from the steps of the train for like a half hour until they came by just so he wouldn't miss the moment. And his hand is lifted just enough so as not to overemphasize his delight and give away that he's performing. It's like he's doing a Goldilocks performance. It's just perfect.
And the story is from her perspective, so we're not sure if he's actually faking it or if it's just how she sees it. And I think this next part is really important.
His wife had an odd sense of lost time. Standing now on the platform with the baby in her arms and small John beside her, she could not for a minute remember clearly whether he was coming home or whether they were yet standing here to say goodbye to him. They had been quarrelling when he left, and she had spent the week of his absence determining to forget that in his presence she had been frightened and hurt. "This'll be a good time to get things straight," she had been telling herself. "While John is gone, I can try to get a hold of myself again." Now, unsure at last whether this was an arrival or a departure, she felt afraid again, straining to meet an unendurable tension. "This will not do," she thought, believing that she was being honest with herself. And as he came down the train steps and walked toward them, she smiled, holding the baby tightly against her so that the touch of its small warmth might bring some genuine tenderness into her smile.
She's been through this so often that she's not really sure where she is in her life. And I think this speaks to the repetitive nature of everybody's existence, but specifically this time in your life, when you've got small kids, it takes all of your attention, but not all of your focus. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important. Your mind wanders a lot and you think, and it can be a bit maddening at times. She admonishes herself for the argument that they had before he left, and she feels that she needs to get a hold of herself.
Yeah.
It says she believed that she was being honest with herself. And I think that's important because throughout the story, there is a shift in reality, and I don't think it is dishonesty at all. I don't think she's lying to herself.
Right.
I don't think it's a put on or she's fantasizing. I think she's really feeling and seeing these things as they are.
She 100% believes that what she perceives as happening is happening.
Yes.
I think the meaning of she believed that she was being honest with herself, she has this kind of disconnect where she can't remember in that moment whether this is a departure or an arrival. As you described, that's a practical thing that can happen if you're taking a repetitive action. In fact, it happened to me last night. I was driving to the grocery store, just lost in my thoughts. And on autopilot, I took a turn I take to pick Heather up from work.
Yep.
And I drove for a moment and then I felt really lost. And then I couldn't remember what I was doing. You know, yeah. I'd only left the house 2 minutes before and I had that feeling of panic for a second. Where am I and what am I doing? Mm-hmm. And it comes from those repetitive, you just follow in a trail and your mind wanders, like you say.
Yep.
But there is another level here because she's admitting that they've had this fight, that she's felt hurt and scared in his presence. Seeing him and not knowing if it's an arrival or a departure, I think means when I see him, am I going to want to patch this up or is it over and somebody has to leave, a departure?
Right.
Is this a rekindling of our affection or is it, am I going to know that this is over when I see him? She does not want to acknowledge, even a little bit, that a breakup or a departure is possible at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so says, this will not do, she says in her head, about having this confusion. The fact that I'm confused will not do. And then she believes she was being honest with herself about that,
right,
that she doesn't want to leave him. Does she really mean this will not do? Well, she believes she does.
Yeah. John gets off the train, interacts with her and the kids in a positive and altogether normal way. They can't really talk because the baby's screaming, so they just get into the car, and once in the seats, the kids calm down.
It says, when Margaret got in beside him, she felt a little chill of animosity at the sight of his hands on the wheel. I can't bear to relinquish even this much, she thought. For a week, no one has driven the car except me. Because she could see so clearly that this was unreasonable, John owned half the car, after all. She said to him with bright interest, and how was your trip? The weather? Beautiful writing, in that Jackson first focuses on those hands. The tension is again about control. That the hands are a symbol for a losing of her independence. For a week, she's been able to take that car, do whatever she wants, and now he's grabbing hold of it with those hands. He's in control.
Right.
To paper over that, she turns back to the performance. How was the weather?
As he drives, Margaret and John talk. Business trip went great, and everyone is really happy. He's going to go back in 2 weeks to wrap it all up, and that's great news. Well, not for Margaret. He has been back for 5 minutes before he slides in that he's taking off again soon.
Yeah, he didn't lead with that. He talked about how great everything was till at the end. And I'll go back in 2 weeks. And she says, the stinger is in the tail.
She knows that it is good news and it's good for the family, but it's going to suck for her. And that made me realize that this isn't just about having somebody take care of the kids. It's about just having another adult around.
Mm.
And it can be very, very lonely when you're alone with those kids. She's feeling that acutely. She says, maybe I can go with you next time and the kids can stay with my mom. And he hesitates, but only for a second, and then says, fine.
She definitely heard that slight hesitation. She doesn't say more about why that's significant that he hesitated, but what do you think it means?
Oh, that means that he wasn't planning on doing it, and then he was going, I'm going to get a break from my family again in 2 weeks. And that's going to be, yeah, okay, we can do that. That's
right.
The sort of thing that I think is going on. I think his fine isn't fine. I don't think he's mad about it because we don't get any of that from him here. I think it's one of those where he wasn't thinking about it. And then he's like, well, I guess that could work fine.
Well, or he's having an affair. He's got things lined up.
There could
be. She's going to come now. So that wrecks what my whole point of doing that was. And he can't tell her that, right? So he's got to play along. Fine. No, that's fine.
But that could be a complete fabrication. I mean, I don't think the text says that he's having an affair anywhere in there. That's
the text doesn't
the
tell
reader.
Us much about him or what he's done at all.
Exactly. And I think that's what makes the story so good is that it's so easy to read so many different things
sure.
out of what's going on here.
I'm like, that guy's got a girl. That's what I thought.
Margaret has the house all fixed up and tidy, and when they get home, Small John goes and plays with his toys, and we get this.
She set the baby down in the playpen and turned with the baby's bonnet and jacket in her hand and saw her husband, head bent gravely as he listened to Small John. Who? She wondered suddenly. Is he taller? That is not my husband.
This is our turn into the strange. She begins to think that this man is not her husband, but an imposter.
It's a body snatch. Mm-hmm. Her husband has been replaced by an exact replica. Typically, here's where you and I would speculate as to whether this is a real supernatural or weird science event that's happening.
Yeah.
What do you think? You don't think there's an actual body snatch that happened?
I don't. I think that this is about a lot of other things.
It would be funny to me if we speculated about all this stuff and then got to go see Shirley Jackson at a conference and she was just mad about it. It's about aliens. They're replacing people one by one, and this is just the first chapter of my Xenon trilogy.
But she would think this is really scary, that my husband's been replaced by an alien. Well, not for her. Mm-hmm. She laughs and makes eye contact with this guy, and there is a look of recognition in his eyes. He knows that she knows that he's not John, and her heart is beating hard, her hands are shaking, and she's excited because she feels relief.
Well, she doesn't, yeah, this is a totally new person, and that's the relief, and then the excitement is they're both in on this together now. He knows that she knows, and mm-hmm. by the way, she doesn't say, I think he's an alien.
No.
She just goes, that's not my husband, it's somebody else who's pretending to be him.
Sure. And I feel like this is a very real feeling because people are complicated. People aren't consistent.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we're receptive and sometimes we're closed off. Sometimes we're in a fun mood. Other times we're pissy jerks. And I think this feeling that she's having now is that he's in a mood that he's not normally in. He's fun and loving John. And maybe that isn't a version of him that she's seen in a long time or ever, maybe.
In the segment that we heard there where she stands and looks at him and thinks that's not my husband, I do believe she's had a break with reality, the character in the story.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, it's a relatable feeling of when you see somebody that you know very well in a new light, it can bring this feeling of excitement. But here, this is rooted in what we were talking about a minute ago. She cannot let herself believe, I think, that this relationship is over, whether it's social norms that are causing that or her mm-hmm. own beliefs in the marriage. But her distaste for him, this yearning for independence, is pulling at her just as strongly as that commitment to the normal. And crack, there's a solution in this mental break. She stays in the relationship, but just decides that her husband's a different person and then throws all of her belief into it. And there's a particularly painful line here. She thinks, this is not the man who enjoyed seeing me cry. I need not be afraid. And we don't know the nature of their fight. I think, you know, you always put a little of yourself into it. So when I'm reading this, I think they just had a fight.
Yeah.
But this comment intimates that it could be abuse, either mental or physical.
Mm-hmm.
That it probably is. This break with reality or this fictional life that she's now experiencing, that's a fear response as much as anything else. Somebody accepts the excuses of an abuser in that type of mm-hmm. relationship. That was an accident. Yeah. That was a one-time thing. This person today isn't the person who did that yesterday. And I need to believe that.
Yeah.
At least until next time.
The rest of the day, she's feeling great and they're really getting along. At dinner, they're both being super fun and funny. It says, they were hilarious at dinner. John would not have made her a cocktail. But when she came downstairs from putting the children to bed, the stranger met her at the foot of the stairs, smiling up at her, and took her arm and led her into the living room where the cocktail shaker and glasses stood on the low table before the fire. He tells her that he wants to build a shelf for the corner of the room. He says that he wants things there, small, delicate things like ivory.
With John, she would have felt it necessary to remark at once that they could not afford such delicate, pretty things, and put a cold finish to the idea. But with the stranger, she said, we'd have to look for them. Not everything would be right.
And I think it's interesting here that she is not acting like herself either. He's different, so she can be different too.
Mm-hmm.
Is this maybe an imposter version of her?
Well, you're right. She's not acting like herself, but that is a response. Her fear response has gone away. The reason she would have put a cold finish to the idea before is because I get the sense that if she asks for things, he yells at her.
Mm.
We can't afford that. You know, right? Because she doesn't fear that that's going to happen. She's able to talk about shopping in a way that she didn't feel like she could before. So yeah, it frees her up.
But also, I think that she would have been criticizing him as well in the way of like, well, we can't afford that. I have to be practical and bring up that we can't afford that thing.
Mm-hmm. Right, right, right.
And this point, she's like, I don't need to say that. That's not what's going on here. Fun is what's going on here.
Yeah.
We're dreaming. Let me jump in on this too, because this is the fun stuff.
Yeah, maybe he always says he wants to get stuff and she's, it actually isn't a fair response. It's frugality. But I still think that kind of frugality would be rooted in her role as head of the household.
Yep.
So
absolutely.
It's an abdication of those responsibilities.
He tells her that he saw a little creature, a tiny little man, all purple, blue, and gold. He would be great for their new shelf.
Well, I wasn't around in the 60s, so I don't know if that's a specific reference to a popular statue of some kind.
Yeah, I don't know anything about it.
But I think it's just meant to represent a knickknack, and they plan together this bookshelf and how they're going to fill it with knickknacks, little figurines. Sounds like they're going to start painting miniatures together, maybe. John says, it looks empty here, and it needs things. Symbols. We need things together, things we like, both of us. Those small, delicate, pretty things. I was trying to think of what this was all about. I mean, I think it comes back down to control and appearances. You know, when they came into their home, I think the way she describes is she says it's a perfect home that you would imagine a perfect family living in. But there's nothing about it that's particular to them. In fact, she sterilizes it a little bit before he gets in there, makes sure to remove the baby clothes and evidence of that work has happened here, you know.
Well, I think there's also in relationships there can be neutral things. Lots of things that don't really bother either person, but for somebody to make a bold choice of like, I like this, and the other person going, well, I don't like that. But finding something that they both like, something that's bold and exciting that they can take a chance together is like, I think that's the dream. I think that's what people want out of the relationships. They don't want to be in neutral space. They want to adventure together.
You're articulating what that is. I think it's a symbol for what you just said. She is missing in this. There again, it's all for him. It's always been all for him, right? And so I imagine. So this new John says, we need to build a space and put things in it that we both like, things for both of us.
The next day, John goes off to work and she takes small John to nursery and stays home with the baby. She has a lovely day and is in a great mood, even though the baby's a bit grumpy. After she picks up small John, he asks, where's Daddy? And she says, Daddy's gone off to the office. And she laughed at the insult to John.
She's cuckolding her husband with this imposter. And it's a thrill.
Right.
Every time something like that happens, she thinks they're both making fun of John together as they have this affair. But in this interaction, you see how her life revolves around him even when he's not there. This tension of the kids wanting to know where he is when he's at work.
The day is going great until she thinks that the imposter might not come back and maybe the real John will come back. And she is crushed by this idea. But when he does come back, it's still the imposter. Yay! They talk over dinner and she's grilling him about his past, seeing if there are gaps in his knowledge. He had not bothered to master all of the past. He had learned enough. The names of the children, the location of the house, how she liked her cocktails. And after that, it was not important. Because either she would want him to stay or she would, calling upon John, send him away again. The next day, John leaves for work. She calls a local teenager to watch the kids and then she heads off into the city to see if she can track down that little man figurine that John was talking about.
She wandered through the strange shops in the town, choosing small, lovely things to stand on the new shelves, looking long and critically at ivories, at small statues, at brightly colored, meaningless, expensive toys suitable for giving to a stranger. In a recent show, we talked about this. I think I was blabbing about returning a cart, you know, how you do things for strangers, and then and that familiarity breeds contempt. You won't treat people you love and that are close to you with as much kindness as you would treat a stranger, and I think that's operative here as well.
On her shopping spree, she finds a few things, but not the little blue, purple, gold man. And it's getting dark out there, so she takes a cab home, anticipating that he might get home before her.
She thought with pleasure that the stranger would be home before her and look from the window to see her hurrying to him. He would think, this is a stranger. I am waiting for a stranger, as he saw her coming. So to your point, she's changed too, and he's going to see that. They're both new people in a new relationship. This affair has made everything better. She comments that she got out of the taxi and paid the driver, who smiled as he drove away. I must look well, she thought. When the driver smiled back at her. So she feels like she even is looking good because this is so exciting. What's going on with her?
You're happy. You get confidence. And then people see that and they treat you different.
Yeah.
After she leaves the cab, something strange strikes Margaret.
She turned and started for the house, and then hesitated. Surely she had come too far? This is not possible, she thought. This cannot be. Surely our house was white? The evening was very dark, and she could see only the houses going in rows, with more rows beyond them and more rows beyond that. And somewhere a house which was hers, with the beautiful stranger inside. And she lost out here.
And that's the end of the story.
Wow.
So good. But it left me with this idea that we can't keep the totality of a person in our mind. A person is insanely complex, so there's no way that we can think of them in all of the ways that they are. So we have to choose what parts to remember when we think of them.
Mm-hmm.
For example, my image of my wife is a construction that I create. If I were to describe her, I would say she's funny, beautiful, charming, quirky, but I'm leaving out tons of stuff about her. You know, maybe sometimes she could be mean. She can be also more than one thing, too. She could be self-conscious, but also confident. She's brave, but cowardly. There's so much complexity to one person. But when we get angry at a person, it's easy for us to say that they are bad, that all of the bad things about them stand out to us, and that we reconstruct them in a way that supports that feeling that we have that they're bad. And we forget about all the other good stuff in any given moment. We can't hold on to all the stuff to make a full image of a person. Like, we're just incapable of it. And I feel like Margaret has an image of her husband in her head, and she forgot that he's more than that image. So all the things that were getting to her, him being mean to her, distant, not being the husband that she needed, not giving her her emotional support, that's all he was to her. When she started seeing these other attributes, she was like, no, that's not him. My husband is not those things. My husband is mean and distant. And so this cannot be him.
Right.
And I think that that's kind of what's going, that's the difference between her and us, is that she's having trouble remembering that, whereas we are able to shift our opinion of people in our lives, our friends, our coworkers. At one moment, we hate their guts. Another moment, they're the best person in the world.
Yeah, yeah.
And at the end, I think Margaret was doing this to herself. She was actually looking, and this is something about us. We all have an idea of who we are, but that self-image changes from moment to moment, depending on our mood. But also in our relationships, we base a lot of who we are on what our significant other thinks of us and what we think of them.
Mm-hmm.
And our children throw in a bunch of other perspectives into the mix. And it's this crazy feedback loop. And I think that this story captures that helplessness that you feel when you're not sure who I am. Because, you know, your role as a parent defines who you are. Your role as a spouse defines who you are. You're as a coworker, as a friend, man, trying to make sense of all that stuff. We're just so limited. And I think that this story explores this idea in a very strange way. What if we could choose how we see people to the point of making them into totally different people?
Yeah, this story touches on all those things. I don't think he changes much when he comes back is the thing. I don't think that he's particularly kind to her or does something that would cause her to think, oh, this is a different person. But to me, I feel like he's acting the same way as he might have before, and she's made a decision to cleanse herself of all those negative things. But I don't necessarily agree that he prompted it.
No, I don't think so at all. I think you're totally right. I think this is how he always acted. It's about her perceptions of her husband. That's what's changed.
Right, right. And I think that it's interesting what you're saying about what there's so many facets that make up who a person is. The things inside of that person, and then also the images of that person that other people hold in their minds. Back when we did that Enchanter's Apprentice role-playing thing.
Right.
It was about that. Do you decide what your identity is, or do other people hold on to it? And if people think good things about you, can you believe that that's part of your identity? Can you throw away the bad things people might think about you because it doesn't actually impact your life? And here, I think in couples especially, you've been together for a long time. Well, I'll tell you, one thing I don't like about Heather is that she never listens to our podcasts. And that's why I'm about to unload on her. No, I'm totally kidding. I do think that we get into habits of preemptive attacks with people that we've known for a long time.
Sure.
Because something happened that made you afraid or made you uncomfortable or maybe it displeased you even in the smallest way.
Mm-hmm.
And because those things happen, you're in continual contact with that person. You decide you're going to head it off. Because you're constantly interacting, not with just that person in the present, but with everything they've ever done.
Oh,
and so you get to the point where you're criticizing, right? Uh-huh. And everybody does it. You go, hey, don't do that, because you're just guessing they're going to do the thing. based off of the past behavior. And of course, nobody likes to be criticized. That gets greeted with a little bit of hostility because you haven't done or not done the thing yet. And you would like the opportunity to try again, to change.
Sure.
Or you don't really want the note. Hey,
yep.
I'm sorry that you don't like that, but guess what? We're not all living just for one another.
Yeah.
So if you could look at somebody with new eyes every time, exercise all of those things that you're reacting to from those past versions of them, that'd be really wonderful.
Yeah.
I think that that's what she discovers. This is freaking great. If I just forget about everything. And I think you can do that.
You can.
With certain relationships I've had with people over long periods of time, I went, maybe, and I'm talking about family members and things like that, you go, maybe if I just stop trying to change them,
yes,
some of this tension will go away.
Uh-huh.
And it does.
Yep. It's true. Absolutely.
If you just go, well, okay, they do that thing, but like if I can just say that's okay, even if I don't like it, or, and not get upset about it, stop setting an expectation that they're going to do it differently, what will that do with the relationship? And usually it makes it way better.
It does.
Unfortunately, that's something you only can do over time, because in some cases people do change as a result of feedback, right? So you got to try, mm-hmm, and create that relationship together and share an experience. And man, this story is about all of that stuff. I do have to say, the disassociation that happens at the very end of the story, that last paragraph we heard, is terrifying for me.
Yeah.
I just wanted to comment on that. This, despite all of the depth in this story, that is a real horror ending to me. That's a nightmare I've had so many times. And me talking about that happening while I was driving to the grocery store last night, that was real fear for a second. Where I don't know where I am. I don't know where I'm going. And that'll happen since I've moved. And I think the ocean's just over there, even though I'm in Wisconsin. I have disassociations like that on a small scale.
Yeah.
But the reason they scare me is because I go, what happens when this grows? And I'm walking and I suddenly don't know why I'm outside or where I'm headed. I don't know how to get home.
Yeah. When you have that image of who you are in your mind, it has changed over time. But there are moments that you flash back, or at least I do, to being that person that I used to be, like being the guy in Los Angeles in the night when I was in my 20s.
Yeah.
And then thinking just as I thought then and looking at my life now going, how the hell did this happen? I live in England in a Victorian terraced house with children. Your self-perception, you can have these slips in time, and it can be shocking and sometimes horrifying.
The companion song for this story is not Beautiful Stranger by Madonna, but it's
Once in a Lifetime.
Talking Heads, right? Yeah, Once in a Lifetime.
Yeah.
This is not my beautiful house. This is not my beautiful wife. I think it speaks to that estrangement that happens. Life goes by so fast.
This story is so awesome, and we could talk about it more because it just is so incredible, so rich. Shirley Jackson is a genius.
Well, one more thing about that ending, and then one more thing about the story as a whole. The ending, the rows and rows and rows of houses, it speaks to another layer that we're not really getting into, which is the societal reproduction of these kinds of relationships and toxicity. And, that she's just one, that this is happening.
Yep.
This distance between the two of them is being replicated millions of times in that neighborhood in a grid that just wraps around the globe. And that was a little horrifying. And then also, I mentioned parasocial relationships at the beginning. And I do think what is happening throughout the story is they are trying to neatly arrange things in a way to exercise the evil. Like if I just show up with the kids and we look picturesque, everything will be okay. He's manicured when he shows up, and if I just conduct myself, everything's going to be okay. If we have small talk about the weather, everything's going to be okay. If we can arrange some action figures in our house in just such a way, everything will be okay. If I have the perfect profile picture, perfect Instagram post, perfect, right? That we're still doing this, which is if I can fake it, then I really will make it. Some places that works, but when it comes to visual representations, it almost never does. It doesn't matter what you're wearing, what your makeup looks like, or how your hair is. You got to address the real things. That's never going to fix them. You cannot wallpaper over real problems,
Absolutely.
And so, gosh, all that stuff is in here. And again, this is why I'm saying right now, Shirley's my favorite author.
She's outstanding.
So much so that I feel bad I just used her first name. I should not have been.
You should have said Miss Jackson.
I should have, for many reasons.
Especially because you're nasty.
That's correct.
I want to thank our patrons.
Yes, I want to thank Andy H., Bay of Pigs, Domingo Carlo Martinez, Jay Simpson, and Jacob Ryan.
I'd like to thank Luke Frischkoff, Matt and Hannah White, Robert Fredona, Samuel, and Sinclair.
And of course, I want to thank our wonderful reader today, Rachel Lackey.
Yeah, if you'd like hearing her voice, check her podcast out, Rachel Watches Star Trek.
You're on that too, I hear.
Oh, yeah.
Who are you again?
I'm Chris Lackey.
Well, I'm Chad Pfeiffer, and that's it for this episode of Strange Studies of Strange Stories. Now get lost, you beautiful strangers.
Strange Studies of Strange Stories.